It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eugene Kissen from Rheumatology, Associate Professor of Medicine, and Head of Resident and Medical Communication for the section. And he's going to talk to us about gout. So welcome.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to come and speak with you all. I think I know many of you. And I'm sorry, I couldn't help but make this title rhyme. But we'll be talking about how to manage gout. So the learning objectives. Hopefully by the end of this talk, you will be able to choose an appropriate therapy for acute gout, decide when urate-lowering therapy is an appropriate intervention for gout, and then how to choose among the therapies for managing chronic gout. So we'll start with age. As you all know, age is one of the primary risk factors for gout. And if you look at U.S. or Canadian data, the risk for developing gout increases substantially after the age of 50. In fact, about 10% of your male patients will probably have gout in their history, and about half of your female patients. So we all know the risk and the tie-in of food and diet with gout, and at least with hyperuricemia, which leads to gout. So if we look at our food pyramid, and I borrowed this slide from Dr. Choi, there are things at the top and at the bottom of this pyramid that increase the risk for gout. So whether we're talking about meat, which we think about, fish, which we may or may not think about, or sweets and fruit, which we certainly didn't used to think about, those are all fairly high-risk foods for hyperuricemia. Luckily, coffee decreases risk, so drink up. Alcohol depends on the type of alcohol, so wine actually is relatively neutral. Beer is high-risk, and liquor is sort of less risky than beer. So where does this play into the management of gout? And it seems that it's politically correct, for whatever reason, to always recommend diet and exercise as an initial treatment. And I think that I personally don't agree with that for someone who has gout as opposed to hyperuricemia. My thought on this is it's sort of like cholesterol lowering in someone who's just has an elevated cholesterol versus someone who's had a myocardial infarction, right? Someone who just has a high cholesterol, you might recommend diet and exercise as an initial step, and that would be reasonable, but probably wouldn't be reasonable for someone who's already had their first MI. So I see the patient with gout as that person who's already had their event. It's a little bit too late to intervene with diet modification, and there have been zero studies that have shown efficacy of dietary restriction for treatment of gout. There's been one study that has shown efficacy in dietary modification for treatment of hyperuricemia. So the alcohol and the sugar story. So it looks like fructose is really as big a risk factor for hyperuricemia as alcohol is. They both increase the breakdown of intracellular ATP, and fructose increases insulin resistance, which also promotes the development of gout. The story with beer is that it contains large quantities of guanosine, which makes it a higher risk than other alcohols. And then don't forget about moonshine as a potential risk for gout, especially if someone was from the Deep South. There is a high rate of positive answers for have you had moonshine, at least in your youth. And the lead that is ingested stays around forever. So you may recognize this fairly famous picture, a description of gout. So the individual goes to bed in good health. During the night, he's awakened by acute pain in the big toe, sometimes in the heel, ankle, or instep. The pain and sensation are so acute that the individual cannot tolerate even the weight of a bed sheet on the toe. And that holds true more often than not. The pain, even for the fairly stoic patient, is enough to bring them in. We'll have some questions to stimulate, hopefully keep you falling asleep. So 75-year-old man with metastatic lung cancer. including brain metastasis, presents for routine follow-up. He reports 4 episodes of podagra in the past 4 months. His uric acid concentration is 9 milligrams per deciliter, and his creatinine is 0.8, weighs 180 pounds. The most appropriate treatment recommendation at this point is 1. Begin allopurinol, 300 milligrams per day. 2. Begin probenecid, 500 milligrams twice a day. 3. Begin colchicine, 0.6 milligrams twice a day. Or 4. Begin prednisone, 10 milligrams a day. So I'll let you key in your answers. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, so we have 44% and the majority recommended beginning allopurinol with an even split between colchicine and prednisone. Let's talk about why colchicine is probably the most appropriate answer here. And to figure that out, you have to sort of think about how is allopurinol or urate lowering going to help in the treatment of someone with recurrent gout attacks. All right, so let's talk about uric acid balance. You have about 2/3 of your purines coming from endogenous sources, and about 1/3 coming from the diet. You end up with a certain amount of uric acid level in the blood, and you excrete the uric acid 2/3 through the kidneys, 1/3 through the gut. So as you get older, potentially larger, potentially have higher cell turnover, that endogenous purine synthesis goes up and the renal function comes down and you're left with a higher uric acid load. Hyperuricemia results from overproduction only about 10% of cases and under excretion in about 90%, and often there's some component of both. The key is when the uric acid concentration goes up above 6.8, and that's the magic number, right? So when it goes up above 6.8, it supersaturates the solution and you get crystallization of the uric acid. Here's another key. It takes 5 to 10 years for that to result in an acute gout attack. 5 to 10 years, which is why we don't generally treat with medication hyperuricemia, because especially in the 75 or 85-year-old, there may be numerous other events that occur before their first gout attack. Now, if you lower their uric acid level, however you do it, let's say it's with allopurinol, how long is it going to take you to achieve your goal? And your goal really isn't to reduce the uric acid level. Your goal is to keep them from having gout attacks, right? How long does that take? So if you look at this cohort of patients, and this is a percentage of the subjects having a gout attack, this is month 2 after initiation of therapy, 4, 6, etc. You can see that in the first couple of months, the number or the chance that they're going to have a gout attack actually goes up, and then it slowly starts to come down. Over here, you see how effective the therapy was. So the allopurinol dose was titrated with a goal of getting a serum uric acid concentration of 6.0 or less. And you can see that by week 28, you already had 82% of patients achieving that goal, and you see that it doesn't really change much from there. You know, there's going to be some non-compliance, there's going to be other issues, so that's about where they get to. So that's about 5 months, right? If you look at 5 months, you still haven't really budged the percentage of patients that have gout flares, and it's really over the next 6 months. So the end of the first year, that you really get a substantial decrease in the number of gout flares. Come somewhere between 6 and 12 months after you've achieved your target uric acid level. So if this patient has metastatic lung cancer and has a relatively short life expectancy, trying to control his gout by reducing your uric acid level is probably not going to be an effective strategy. And you're probably going to be better off suppressing the inflammation, which will work quickly. In case you missed it, the goal uric acid concentration is 6.0 or less. So let's go on to the next question. A 102-year-old woman presents with recurrent episodes of acute mono or oligoarticular arthritis involving the small, medium-sized joints every 3 to 4 months. She had a synovial fluid aspirate 3 years ago, demonstrating monosodium urate crystals. Currently, she has a swollen, very painful right ankle and left wrist for the past 2 days. She's been on 100 milligrams of allopurinol for the past year, and her serum uric acid concentration today is 5.7. Her creatinine is 1.5, and her weight is 110 pounds. The next step in management should be, 1, switch allopurinol to febuxostat, 2, give her a 2-week course of ibuprofen, 400 milligrams 3 times a day, 3, give her colchicine, 0.6 milligrams every hour until her attack stops, or you get to 6 pills, or she develops diarrhea, or 4, give her prednisone, 40 milligrams per day, taper over a week. Go ahead and key in your answers. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 60% of you said prednisone, which is very good, because that is the correct answer. Let's talk about the answer choices. You know, the treatments for acute gout include rest and ice, which is what was used back in the 1700s and 1800s. You know, if you don't have another safe therapy, that may still be the choice, but that is probably the right choice about 1% or 0.1% of the time now. Your other choices are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and the mistake that I see made with this intervention is that non-anti-inflammatory doses are given. So 400 milligrams of ibuprofen is analgesia, not anti-inflammatory. So if you're concerned that because of her creatinine that is too much ibuprofen, then you have to use something else. You can use systemic or intra-articular glucocorticoids. The safest choice is intra-articular glucocorticoids because if done properly, the risks are really minuscule. The problem is if it's a polyarticular attack, how many joints are you going to inject? And the second problem is will the patient let you? Systemic corticosteroids work well as long as there are no real contraindications. And the main problem is if someone has poorly controlled blood sugars, that may require an inpatient hospitalization to get everything managed. Colchicine. So, IV colchicine was banned in 2008, and the rest of colchicine was banned this year, right? So you may have run into this problem. The FDA, in all its wisdom, decided that colchicine, since it had not been FDA approved, needs to go through the FDA approval process. And they sent out a notice to all the manufacturers of colchicine, and no one came forward. And then they sent out another invitation, and one company came forward, and the FDA said, look, you do the studies, and we'll give you exclusivity to market colchicine for gout for 3 years. So they did a study, and now the cost of colchicine has gone up from $4 a month to $100 a month. So here's what we got for our money, the study. So if you look at colchicine and you divide it into high-dose colchicine, that's the recipe of one pill every hour until the person gets diarrhea, because that's invariably what happens. Low-dose colchicine, which is two pills up front and then a third pill 1 hour later, or just one pill of colchicine. You can see that the peak concentrations of colchicine are the same for the low and the high-dose groups. The way colchicine works on inflammation is it prevents neutrophil chemotaxis to the party in the toe. And that has to happen quickly because once all the neutrophils are there, it's not really going to be an effective therapy. So this is a good therapy when the patient initiates it. If they have it at home and within the hour of feeling the attack coming on, they can take a pill or two, then it works pretty well. If they have to wait to see you the next day, it becomes much less effective. And if they have to wait 2 or 3 days for someone to catch on that they're having a gout attack in the hospital, it's almost non-effective. Now, if you look at the gastrointestinal side effects for the high dose, 77% had diarrhea. A low dose, it was actually fairly close to placebo, 25% versus 20%. And the only severe diarrhea occurred in the high-dose group. So that's just not the way it should be dosed. Many of us knew this already, but now we have a very high price tag to confirm our clinical suspicion. If you look at the efficacy, This is the percentage of patients improved, and this is how much they've improved. So really, we want to be here in the 80-plus percent range, when they're really pretty much better. And if you look, there's really no difference in the lines between the high-dose and the low-dose groups. And unfortunately, you see that with either group, the percentage of patients improved to 80% or better is only about 20%. This is a study where the colchicine was initiated in about 12 to 24 hours after the attack began. Okay. So it can work, but it's not the best treatment. You're probably going to get more results from nonsteroidals or corticosteroids, either intra-articular or systemic. So this 102-year-old woman follows up 4 weeks later.
In the old days, they used to use ACTH, one thing, they took that out.
Yes, unfortunately, it's not manufactured. It hasn't been banned, just not being manufactured. And it wasn't clear that it worked much better than a high dose of corticosteroids. It may have had a small uricosuric effect as well. But for the acute gout episode, that's really not your goal. The only difference as far as which nonsteroidal to use is which one is fastest onset. You can use an equal potent dose of ibuprofen and indomethacin. The real difference is that time to onset is a little bit faster with indomethacin, so perhaps that's a benefit. The toxicity of indomethacin is higher also. So you may as well just use whatever they have on hand. If they have ibuprofen or Advil at home, or they can get it very quickly at the pharmacy, that's probably going to be better than having to go through the process of writing them a prescription, having them wait to get it, and it's time. It's how quickly you get it into their system, basically, is the best answer. So a 102-year-old woman follows up in 4 weeks, recovered from her attack. Your resident wants to recheck her uric acid level. You should, 1, recheck her uric acid level. 2, ignore the resident and increase her allopurinol to 200 milligrams a day. 3, ignore the resident and switch allopurinol to probenecid, 500 milligrams a day. Or 4, ignore the resident and add febuxostat, 40 milligrams a day. The majority of you said recheck the uric acid level, and just slightly less said increase the allopurinol. So, congratulations, that is a correct answer. And why? Why do you want to recheck it? Didn't you just see that her uric acid level was 5.7 just 4 weeks ago? Well, the problem is that was during a period of an acute attack, and the uric acid level is not reliable during an acute attack. If you look at serum uric acid levels during an attack and after the attack, about a week later, you can see that in almost all cases, the serum uric acid level is substantially higher when they're pain-free. And you may also notice that the serum uric acid level is below 6 in a substantial proportion of these patients during the attack and not in any after their attack. So if you go on that 5.7, you may think that her allopurinol dose is appropriate, and you might be making a mistake because her uric acid concentration might be 7. Why? Probably two reasons. One is if you look at the fractional excretion of urea during an attack and after attack, you can see that there is more excretion during the attack, probably related to a systemic cortisol release. So there peeing out the uric acid level, which may decrease in the short term the uric acid level concentration. The second is an antidiuretic hormone release related to severe pain that causes free water absorption and dilution of everything, including the uric acid level. So it would make sense to not check a uric acid level during an attack, really ever, and only check it after they've recovered. Next case. A 72-year-old man presents to the clinic after having recovered from a severe initial attack of gout, for which he was hospitalized for a week due to inability to walk, had glycemic control difficulties induced by the prednisone treatment. He has a creatinine of 1.5, weighs 200 pounds. He has a history of urolithiasis. The most appropriate treatment recommendation at this point is, 1, start allopurinol 100 milligrams a day, two, start colchicine 0.6 milligrams a day. Three, start allopurinol and colchicine, or just give him PRN colchicine to use for the next attack. Even split allopurinol and colchicine. This question really gets at two issues. One is, when do you recommend urate-lowering therapy, and what are the indications for that? Let's start with that point. So the established indications are frequent attacks, which means more than two or three attacks per year, generally. Tophaceous gout, advanced gouty arthritis, history of urolithiasis. Here's an image of chronic tophaceous gout. This image was borrowed from Dr. Choi, and this is a dual energy CT, which can differentiate uric acid, which is shown in red, calcium in blue, which you don't see, and water in gray. So you can see that the deposits of uric acid crystals are spread throughout the joints and in the tendon sheaths and in the soft tissues throughout the skin. This is tophaceous gout, and even if this person has not had a single attack, the appropriate recommendation is for urate-lowering therapy. This is what it looks like on ultrasound. This is a MCP joint, and you can see this large deposit. It looks inhomogeneous on ultrasound, and then there's this urate line. It's a hyperechoic line over the hyaline cartilage, and that is fairly diagnostic of gout. If you look at this cadaveric specimen, you can see the tophaceous deposit on this PIP, and you can see it nicely shown on the ultrasound image. You can also see this double line of the uric acid crystals lining the hyaline cartilage. You can see this microspicules of uric acid right on the hyaline cartilage. That's how it usually deposits. If you wait long enough, you get more obvious changes on radiographs. So this is chronic tophaceous gout that's erosive. You can see this overhanging ledge, which is pathognomonic for gout on plain radiographs. And again, if you see this on radiograph, even if they haven't had a single attack of gout, you would want to start them on urate-lowering therapy. And the amazing thing is that most of these seemingly devastating erosions will actually fill in and go back to looking fairly normal if they're treated long enough. Now, we have another ultrasound image, this time of the kidney. You can see the kidney stones. Here's a bladder, and you see all the stones on the bladder. And again, even if they haven't had a single attack of gout, if they're hyperuricemic and have history of kidney stones, it would make sense to go ahead and lower their serum uric acid level. Those are the typical indications for gout. They've been around for a long time. And the more recent indication is someone with decreased kidney function. So there have been a number of studies that have shown that in someone with decreased renal function and hyperuricemia, that if you reduce their uric acid level, especially with allopurinol, that the further decline in kidney function is decreased by about half. So you may delay the progression of their renal loss. So if you have someone with a single attack of gout and their creatinine is subpar, you may want to think about urate-lowering therapy just on that basis alone. Now, go ahead.
Okay, so on the ultrasound, so if we have somebody we think might be gout, we used to always talk about plain films, they really don't show much. Would an ultrasound, we can't tap it for whatever reason, would an ultrasound be, for early gout or detection of gout, the way to go these days?
I think that it can be helpful. The problem with ultrasound for gout is it cannot definitively differentiate gout from pseudo-gout. In the knee, it probably can. In the smaller joints, it's much more difficult. It can tell you that it is a crystalline arthritis, and it's pretty good for differentiating crystalline arthritis from some other cause of joint pain. And if you have a pretest, you know, probability of having gout already at 80%, it'll probably get you to the 95% plus percent range. But if there is some suspicion, maybe this is gout, maybe this is calcium pyrophosphate disease, you're still probably going to want to get a synovial fluid aspirate to answer that question. in the patient who just says, no, we'll not have that done, I think it's a reasonable thing to do.
How long do you wait to start calcineurin medication from when the, treating the acute attack? What's the appropriate?
There's not an answer in the literature for that, but most of us will wait about a month. Let me answer that in the context of my next slide.
Okay.
Was there another question?
I was going to ask actually about allopurinol with severe renal dose.
I'm going to get to that as well. So the question about colchicine. So there's this entity called mobilization gout. And when you change uric acid levels, even for the better, you decrease them, what happens is you start to melt the uric acid crystals. And as they come out of the relatively protected environment of the tophus, which has some chronic fibrous deposits around it that sort of protects it from the immune system, you can actually stimulate the immune system and cause an initial flare-up in their acute gout, which is what we saw in that previous slide. For that reason, it's now recommended, unless there's a contraindication, that either NSAIDs or colchicine be dosed with the allopurinol for an initial period of time until you've gotten their uric acid level down to where you want it, which is 6.0 or less, and stable. And how long? The answer is anywhere from 4 to 6 months, usually, and then you can try stopping it. And then if they have a flare-up, give them another 3 or 4 months of colchicine, and then try stopping it again. As far as if you're not using a urate-lowering therapy, then you taper the colchicine like you would the prednisone. So you give them the colchicine at 3 pills until their attack subsides, and then you may put them on 1 pill twice a day for normal kidney function, and probably once a day or even half a pill a day if they have decreased renal function for another week or two. And then if you're not going to chronically prophylax them, then you would stop. Your discussion with the patient about pros and cons of allopurinol should include the risk of severe hypersensitivity reaction, which can present as Stevens-Johnson syndrome, acute interstitial nephritis, acute allergic hepatitis, and or fever. The risk of this reaction seems to be associated with renal insufficiency and with diuretic use. Interestingly, the studies are split on whether the dose of allopurinol is related or not. 3 studies say yes, 3 studies say no. And this has been to be reported as high as 3%, 0.3%, 0.03%, or 0.003%. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, so you answered correctly, 0.3%. And this patient that you see is the, so far, luckily, my only patient that's developed this reaction. Unfortunately, for this patient, it was started by another physician for the treatment of an acute gout flare. Interestingly, this patient has a comorbidity of lupus and just so happens that the rash came out in the shape of a butterfly. I don't know how that happened. So allopurinol can be dosed anywhere from 100 to 800 milligrams a day. It is the most common drug to use for urate-lowering therapy, and you can use it whether the person is an under-excreter or overproducer, whichever. You can use it in patients with low GFR. You can use it in patients with kidney stones. You want to start with a decreased dose in someone with renal insufficiency, but that doesn't necessarily prevent you from increasing the dose later. So the side effects are minor skin reactions in about 2% of patients, so you'll see that, and then this severe reaction, which has a 20% fatality rate. There's a nice study in 1981 looking at the major hospitals in New York, and they looked at 1,835 hospitalized patients who received allopurinol. 5 of them developed life-threatening adverse events. that were definitively thought to be related to the Aleph Journal. One of these was due to the co-administration of azathioprine, and that's something that you really need to watch out for. Two were these severe hypersensitivity reactions. And if you look at the incidence of drug fever, about 0.3%, the incidence of hepatotoxicity, about 0.2%, they had one patient that had acute tubular necrosis. So that's the discussion. Now, this patient with renal insufficiency accepts your recommendation to start allopurinol and ultracine, and you will now need to monitor for all of the following potential complications of chronic ultracine use, because he's going to be on it for 6 months, except myelosuppression, hyperpigmentation, neuropathy, or myopathy. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, so most of you said neuropathy. The correct answer is hyperpigmentation. So colchicine does not cause hyperpigmentation. It can cause myelosuppression, and it can cause this neuromyopathy. It presents as proximal muscle weakness. It's associated with elevated CPK enzymes. So in your patient with cardiac disease, and most of these patients will, who gets admitted for their rule-out MI, and they have a normal MB fraction, but their CK is 5 or 600, and they happen to be on colchicine for their gout, think about this. It's usually accompanied by a mild axonal polyneuropathy, and this side effect tends to occur in patients with renal insufficiency and patients who take more than 2 pills a day. Certainly, especially in someone with both liver and kidney dysfunction, you need to watch out for. Now, luckily, this is a reversible toxicity, so if you take them off their colchicine, probably a few months later, they'll be back to normal. You just have to glue into it. This is the typical H&E biopsy of the muscle, and you can see this toxic granulation vacuole, and this is the EM. These are normal muscle fibers, and you can see that they just become disorganized due to the colchicine effect on the microtubules. Which of the following medications has been shown to cause a dose-dependent worsening of renal insufficiency? Allopurinol, colchicine, both. We have our 17 or 18 responders. 19? New voters. Okay. So 47% of you said both. And unfortunately, the answer is neither.
neither. To see if people listen.
So neither colchicine nor allopurinol cause a dose-dependent decline in kidney function. Either one of them can cause allergic interstitial nephritis, but that's not dose-dependent. Okay. So unfortunately, that is the prevailing thought, and it keeps people from getting appropriately treated. So if you have someone with a creatinine of 2, a lot of physicians are afraid to push the dose of the allopurinol because they're afraid that they're going to make the kidney function worse. And that's not going to happen. It's never been reported. Same thing for colchicine. Other things will happen. And you can develop myelosuppression because the dose is too high. You can develop myopathy and neuromyopathy because the colchicine dose is too high for the kidney function, but you're not going to cause damage to the kidneys. So when you're monitoring for these drugs, if you're worried about too high a dose of allopurinol, you examine the skin for the rash, you check their CBC for myelosuppression, and you check their liver function tests. And if all of those things are okay, then you're not getting toxicity from the allopurinol, and you can keep going. The studies, there have been a few studies on that, and they were not in a specific population of kidney disease. These were not all diabetic kidney disease, or they were not all hypertensive kidney disease. They were sort of a mixed bag. There is some thought that there may also be an antioxidant effect of allopurinol, but I think most people think that it's actually the reduced uric acid and not the medication that is responsible. Last case. An 80-year-old man presents with enlarging tophi over multiple regions despite being on 300 milligrams of allopurinol each day His creatinine is 1.8, and he weighs 150 pounds. What's the best next step in the management of his gout? These are his fingers. Check his uric acid level and add probenecid. 2, check his uric acid level and increase his allopurinol to 450 milligrams a day. 3, check his uric acid level and switch allopurinol to febuxostat, 80 milligrams a day. Or 4, check his uric acid level and add febuxostat, 40 milligrams a day. So 50% of you said check the uric acid level and increase the allopurinol to 450 milligrams a day, which is the correct answer. So what do you think, why do you think his tophus is growing despite being on 300 milligrams of allopurinol? And that's really a high dose, especially given that his creatinine is 0.8. So why do you think his tophus is growing? There are really only 2 possibilities here. One possibility is that even though he's on 300 milligrams of allopurinol, his serum uric acid level has not dropped below 6.8. And if you take all comers, what percentage, at least as reported in a New England Journal study, what percentage of gout patients will achieve a serum uric acid level of 6.0 or less when they're given the appropriate dose based on the creatinine clearance? What percentage of gout patients do you think achieve that goal? 21%. Okay, so the small minority. The second possibility here is that he's just not taking it. And if he's not taking it, increasing the dose won't help matters any. Alright, so here's a study where they took patients with renal dysfunction and they gave them a dose of allopurinol based on their creatinine clearance, and then they increased the dose monthly, stepwise, until they achieve a serum uric acid concentration of 6.0 or less. They had 100 patients. Out of that 100 patients, they had 2 patients that developed a minor skin reaction and had to be taken off, and everyone else did fine. And this is their paradigm. So you dose according to renal function, wait a month, check uric acid level. Increase by 50 milligrams if you want to be cautious, 100 milligrams if you're less cautious, wait for a month, check their CBC, check their LFTs, recheck their uric acid, and have them call you if they develop fever or rash. And you keep doing this monthly until you get to the goal. It's that simple. And usually by the time you've gone to 800 milligrams, their serum uric acid level is where you need it. And I couldn't help but including some polarized light microscopy pictures of tophaceous gout and non-tophaceous gout.
So what's the average dose that Court ended up on?
So the average dose ended up being, I think it was in the 450 milligrams range. So what happens is the tophus disappears, and there's a little dimple because the skin's been stretched. Okay, the tophus will disappear. You just have to be patient. And you may ask, well, how long will it take for this tophus to disappear? And in the study, they looked at patients in whom they reduced, with tophi, in whom they reduced the serum urate concentration to 5.37, 4.22, and 3.97. I think the drugs that they used are relevant here. And you can see that the velocity of reduction is linear, 0.57, 1.2, 1.5. So the further you drop the serum concentration of uric acid, the faster those tophi will melt. Now, if you're melting the tophus at 1 millimeter a month and you have a 1 centimeter tophus, that's going to take you at least a year to get it down. So it's going to take some time, and you have to be patient, and you have to explain to the patient that they have to be patient. But these tophi didn't appear overnight either. Now, I've mentioned febuxostat a few times, and I've gotten some questions about it, so I thought I would bring it up. And this is a non-purine xanthine oxidase inhibitor. It's a great new option. It's the first new drug for gout in like 40 or 50 years. And it works as well as allopurinol. Okay? This is what 4 different studies have shown. you can see the percentage of subjects that reach that goal serum uric acid concentration of 6 or less is about 40% in this study, about 56 here, 36 here. You can see that if you go up to 80 milligrams, you get a much better result. Of course, they didn't double the allopurinol dose for comparison. And the cost of allopurinol for a month's supply is $7, $4 if you get it at Walmart, $166 for the febuxostat. So really, there is a niche for this medication, and it's that patient in whom you give them allopurinol and they develop a reaction, whether minor or major reaction. Before, you were stuck. You were stuck either trying to do desensitization, which is difficult, or just couldn't give them a urate-lowering therapy. Now you have an option. For those patients, this is a great option. But not for the patient who is, quote, resistant to allopurinol. There is no such thing. If you give them enough allopurinol, their uric acid concentration will come down. I've yet to see a patient who took their allopurinol and whom 800 milligrams of allopurinol didn't bring that serum uric acid concentration to 6 or less. So, we have 10 minutes remaining.
You maintain that level of allopurinol, 800 milligrams,
from there on out. If the reaction to allopurinol tends to occur within the first 4 to 6 weeks, and if it hasn't occurred, I mean, it's possible, but it's very unlikely that they're going to develop an allergic reaction later. If you take them off, their uric acid is going to go back to where it was before, and a year or two later, they're going to be having a gout attack.
The control of the CAT scan.
If you want to do a research study in gout, I think is really where that... It's a pretty picture. Well, there's no reason you can't have them on allopurinol.
Okay.
Right? Now, the only thing is that they can't take anything PO, then there's no reason for them not to be on their allopurinol at all. The colchicine, there is some, I mean, you're irritating the gastrointestinal tract. It's not irritating it like a non-steroidal, but you're causing them to get upset. And if they start to vomit or have diarrhea from the colchicine, even though, you know, it just mechanically might not be great as far as inducing a re-bleed if they had a bleed for some other reason. But it's not going to cause an ulcer. I think it depends on which PPI it is. At worst, you just, you know, reduce the dose. You may go to a half a pill of colchicine instead of the full pill.
So tell me if I got this right. So I think at the beginning of your time, you said that 10% of gout cases are due to increased production and 90% are due to under-excretion.
Correct.
So you didn't mention what the role of probenecid is.
Right. So we can talk about probenecid. And probenecid is a reasonable drug to use in those patients that are under-excretors, which is the majority. Why don't we use it more? The problem is that, one, if you want to use probenecid, you have to be sure that they're not overproducers. For allopurinol, you don't care. So you have to check a 24-hour urine sample to see how much uric acid they're excreting. If it's less than 600, you can use it. If it's more than 800 milligrams, then you really shouldn't, and 600 to 800, potentially use it. So that's a second hindrance. Third hindrance is it's at least BID dosing and all sorts of noncompliance that goes, you know, that comes into BID dosing rather than daily dosing. And four, there are lots of P450 interactions of probenecid. We think of the one with penicillin, but there are lots of others. So those are the reasons that we don't use it. If someone has kidney stones, you wouldn't want to use it. And if someone has large tophi, you worry that if you really substantially increase the amount of uric acid that they excrete, you again could cause tophus. So, and then finally, if there are creatinine clearances... If their creatinine clearance is less than 50, then it won't work very well. So you're just going to be wasting time with it. So that's why that encompasses so many of the patients that we would treat with urate-lowering therapy in the first place that it sort of gets forgotten about. But for the person with normal kidney function and without huge tophi and who is allergic to allopurinol, then it would be a reasonable choice. And it's certainly less expensive than febuxostat.
In someone with atypical pain, or the high uric acid, you put on colchicine, but you maybe that's it.
Meaning colchicine long term?
Well, as if they respond to colchicine, then.
It depends on how often. So if they don't have any other reasons to be on a urate lowering therapy, then potentially they could just use a board of colchicine. So they just take it when they have an attack for a while, as long as their attacks aren't coming very frequently. And then you can figure out whether it's gout or pseudo-gout later when the attacks become more frequent or when you develop other things in the medical history that would indicate urate lowering therapy if they were in fact, if they in fact had gout. At that point, you would want to try to push them to have a real diagnosis. But if they're not, they're relatively healthy, they're not having much attacks, sure, you can use NSAIDs or colchicine as abortive agents for a while. Okay, so in case you want to, we can see if you've learned anything or if I've taught you anything. So, 75-year-old man presents with metastatic lung cancer, brain mets, reports 4 episodes of podagra in the past 4 months, uric acid concentration is 9, creatinine is 0.8, most appropriate treatment is allopurinol, probenicid, colchicine, or prednisone. All right, that's much better. And 102-year-old woman presents with recurrent episodes of acute mono to oligoarticular arthritis, has crystal-proven gout, has a swollen, painful wrist and ankle, and has been on 100 milligrams of allopurinol for the past year. Uric acid is 5.7, creatinine is 1.5. Next step is to switch allopurinol to Buxostat, 2-week course of ibuprofen, 400 TID, colchicine 0.6 every hour, or prednisone 40 milligrams over a week. You guys did well on this before, and you definitely did well on it now. Now she follows up 4 weeks later. Your resident wants to recheck your uric acid level. You should recheck it. Ignore resident, add allopurinol. Ignore resident, add probenicid. Ignore resident, add febuxostat. And very good. You're listening. 72-year-old man presents the clinic after having recovered from severe initial attack of gout, from which he is hospitalized for a week, had glycemic difficulties induced by prednisone, creatinine of 1.5, history of kidney stones. Most appropriate treatment recommendation is to start allopurinol, start colchicine, start both, or give him PRN colchicine. Okay. Discuss the patients the pros and cons of allopurinol, discuss the risk of the Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and that risk is reported to be as high as 3.3, 0.03, or 0.003, 100%. And this patient with renal insufficiency accepts the recommendation. The complications of chronic colchicine do not include myelosuppression, hyperpigmentation, neuropathy, or myopathy. Right, hyperpigmentation is not included. Which of the following has been shown to cause the dose-dependent worsening of renal insufficiency? Allopurinol, colchicine, both, or neither. 80-year-old man presents with enlarging tophi, multiple regions, despite being on 300 milligrams of allopurinol, creatinine 1.8. What is the best next step in management? Check uric acid, add probenicid. Check uric acid, increase allopurinol. Check uric acid, switch to febuxostat. Or check uric acid and add febuxostat. 100%. Thank you very much for your attention.